Good morning.
Today we're beginning the first lecture by discussing methods and sources in New Testament, I'll say New Testament historiography. Now, let me do a little contrast this morning to begin. The way New Testament scholars or New Testament historians in the past would try to see if there's some basis for historicity or historical events and the Gospels. There's an old path, and let's talk old path and new path. The old path would be to try to make sure you know or ascertain the authorship of the four Gospels, and to argue that the four Gospels are apostles, or those very close to apostles, and as such, they are in a position to know what happened to the historical Jesus. The trend today, let me back up, that first approach, let's think of it as a top-down kind of approach. And the idea is, if we know our sources are true, then what is recorded in those sources would generally be considered to be true to a certain greater or lesser extent. In other words, if we know the authors, we know where they came from, we know when the books are written, we can trust the contents of the book. So it's kind of a top-heavy kind of approach that says we have documents, we have the best documents, and therefore they're close to Jesus. I mean, if you want to date the Gospels real quickly, you might start with Mark in 65 to 75 AD. This is the way the critical scholars date them. Mark would be 65 to 75 AD. Matthew would be about 80. Luke would be about 85. And John would be about 95. Evangelicals quite frequently date Matthew and Luke about 20 years earlier, and Mark a little earlier than that. But still, that's the general framework. And whichever date you use, they're close enough to the material, they're close enough to 30-ish AD to be considered reliable sources. And apologetics often divides into two tasks with these texts. To say, first of all, we have good textual evidence for them, and secondly, that textual evidence corresponds to the facts. Now, let me explain each of those real quickly, and then I'll move into the second way here today. Many Christians, when they're doing apologetics, they think it's sufficient to say that we have excellent textual evidence for the New Testament, and we do. I've been in many dialogues where critics will say, I'm not even going to question the textual tradition coming down from the Gospels. I'll give you an example. Our earliest papyri, our earliest materials coming from the New Testament, what are the earliest collections are called the Chester Beatty and Bodmer papyri, simply the names for the collections. They contain about 60% of the New Testament, and they're from a very early date. So we have the earliest texts very close to the close of the New Testament, very close to 100 AD. Now, but that only says that we have good copies. Christians often leave the second step out, and they ought not, because we can have good copies of something and have those copies not be reliable. So the second step is to say, for this, and this reasons, these manuscripts are reliable. And we use archaeology, we use historical correspondence to ancient historians, say Josephus would be a great example, or early Christian sources like Clement and Ignatius and Polycarp and so on. And so two steps. This is the old way New Testament methodology was done. And I say old, it's still done today, but it's done less and less. So you say the authorship is firm, we have early texts, and the texts correspond to the historical data. But starting a few decades ago, I mean, this has been going on for a while, but especially in the last couple decades, consistent with a movement known today as the Third Quest for the Historical Jesus, the move is to work from the bottom up, not to work from the top down. Now again, just to, I hope I'm not losing you on this, but the top down is to deal with the text as a whole and to say everything under the text looks reliable, and then you say, well, here's the text and here's a passage in the text, it must be okay because it came from a good source. The method I'm going to talk about this morning works from the bottom up. And the illustration I would use would be, say, a brick wall. Now, you put a brick wall together, a brick at a time. And when you start with small bricks, you can work at it for a while, and you can end up with a rather large, rather tall, rather long wall, just a brick at a time. And that's the method I'm going to talk about this morning. New Testament scholars look for gospel texts. These are largely applied only to the gospels. And they look for passages that fulfill certain rules. Now, this isn't something that New Testament scholars have come up with on their own. They've actually borrowed these rules from historians. To use an example that one ancient historian uses, he says, if all our early sources say derogatory things about Julius Caesar, for example, if all our sources say derogatory things, but consistently the texts say he was a very brave man or he was a very good leader, well, since they're so critical, since these texts are so critical, when they say Julius Caesar was a brave man or Julius Caesar was an excellent general, we can pretty well trust that those aspects are true. All right, well, what happens if we apply that kind of thinking to the New Testament? How many texts will we have that fulfill certain rules? And these are called criteria in the New Testament. New Testament criteria. Now, these first two I'm going to put up together because very frequently, depending on how liberal the New Testament commentator is, they don't think we have as many of these as apologists do. But I think it's increasingly the case that we need to talk about these two sources. For example, Richard Baucom's book of just a few years ago, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, almost 500 pages of introducing a different set of criteria for showing that the New Testament is reliable. And his has to do with male and female names, place names. So he does deal with early sources. For example, he argues that there's eyewitness testimony behind the Gospel of John. That's pretty rare in recent research. But this is a very sophisticated book. Richard Baucom is professor at Cambridge University. And he's arguing for some of these same categories. So I think these need to be back on the plate to talk about. In fact, my last lecture today looks for this kind of data with regard to the resurrection of Jesus. So if we can hold off on numbers 1 and 2, I'm going to talk about getting back to 30 AD, how we can get all the way back to the death of Jesus with our earliest sources, if that makes sense. And I'm going to take a different path back to 30 AD to tell that the earliest disciples believed that Jesus appeared to them, and we have this in our earliest sources. This is a different way of looking at things, but it's largely admitted today by the critics. Bart Ehrman, easily the best known North American New Testament critic, he's an agnostic. In fact, he calls himself an agnostic leaning toward atheism. He says, absolutely correct. We have sources that are good enough and early enough to take us all the way back to the cross. He says that we have source material that will take us within 1 to 2 years of the crucifixion. So whenever you have data of that sort from these two categories, that's very, very important. Those are very important bricks. So whatever you think, whatever can be taken from early eyewitnesses can be mistaken, of course, but what would you rather have? Late non-eyewitnesses? You know, what would you rather apply? For example, our best sources for Alexander the Great, Lives of Alexander, written by Plutarch and by Arrian, are 400 to 450 years after Alexander. Now, scholars are quick to say, yes, but they had earlier sources, and so they did. But you tell me, if you're trying to establish somebody's life historically, do you want to use sources that are 400 to 450 years after their life? Or do you want to use sources that are 35 years later, or 45, or at the maximum, with the Gospel of John, 65 years after the source? Maximum of 65, earliest of 35, with the Gospels alone. But tonight, Lord willing, I want to argue that we can get our sources go back to 30 AD. More about that a little bit later today. One of the most important tests that give us bricks, that help us to put together bricks from the historical Jesus, is multiple attestation of sources. Let me once again put two more up here. Multiple attestation of sources and multiple attestation of forms. This is our two heads are better than one principle. And to have independent sources in the ancient world is often very rare. For example, the Jesus Seminar in North America, although it's come to Europe, there is a British version, and I imagine there are some continental Europeans that subscribe to this too, but the British version and the American version of the Jesus Seminar are, for the most part, fairly radical scholars. And what they became known for was a process of taking beads with four colors: red, pink, gray, and black. And when they would entertain first the sayings of Jesus, the so-called red letter words in the New Testament, and then the acts of Jesus, the events, they would cast their vote by putting beads into a container. And red means Jesus said this. Pink means probably. Gray means probably not. And black means there's no way. And from this test, they reject 80 to 90% of the so-called red letter words of Jesus. So it's a pretty skeptical criterion. And yet, being that skeptical, they still say that if you have two independent sources for an event, that is a good argument that saying is historical. Two. Okay? Well, multiple attestation of sources. Now, multiple attestation of forms means it comes in, for example, the New Testament, we have parables, we have sermons, we have event summaries. Those are forms. Different kinds of literature, let's say, or different kinds of descriptions. So scholars look for different kinds of sources. For example, if Mark and John both report, as they do, if Mark and John both report that Jesus' brother, James, was an unbeliever when Jesus was working his public ministry, that would be two independent sources, because Mark and John are independent of one another. So that would be two. And two is a pretty good argument. But what happens when Bart Ehrman, who's telling us why nobody, no scholar, no New Testament historian would doubt Jesus' death by crucifixion, he lists 11 sources for Jesus within 100 years of his death. Now again, Bart Ehrman is the quote-unquote agnostic leaning toward atheism. He's not conservative at all. And he lists 11 independent sources for the crucifixion. So if you have 11 independent sources, I mean, that's a number three. That's overkill. That's way more than you need. If two is a good argument, 11 is just excellent. And so that's how multiple attestation works. Now, some of his sources, by the way, are non-Christian. And I will add this to Bart Ehrman's 11 sources within 100 years. If you extend that time from 100 years to about 150 or 160, you're going to double your sources. So if you do the first 100 years, you have about 11 sources for the crucifixion of Jesus. If you go to 150 or 160 years, you have 22 sources for the historical Jesus. And I mean, that's double overkill, if you use my example. But what that is a wealth of evidence, or a lot of data. So now each one of these theoretically would be bricks, okay? Using my bricks illustration, every one of these would be bricks. So you have different sources that give different aspects of the crucifixion. And now we could sit here and say, all right, my next lecture is going to be on what we know about the crucifixion within 100 years after Jesus' birth. And then you have these bricks, all these independent bricks that we know. So we're building up our wall of the historical Jesus with bricks, and these bricks would come from multiple attestation of sources and different kinds of literary genres or forms within the sources. Like I said, there's a difference between a parable and a sermon. So those would be different sorts of material, but they both count. They count as types of bricks. Discontinuity and its sister, double discontinuity, are some very strict, very skeptical tests for sayings of Jesus. But when you find things that work, it's very, very useful. Now let me define discontinuity. When skeptical scholars ask, how can we make sure that Jesus uttered a certain sort of statement? They will say, well, tell me something. The best case we could make for a saying being from Jesus is if, on the one hand, discontinuity, on the one hand, this saying is not a Jewish saying. It's non-Jewish. On the one hand, it's non-Jewish. On the other hand, it doesn't come from the early church. You don't find it in this form in the epistles. Okay, so let me say this again. Jesus obviously taught a lot of things that were Jewish in nature, Old Testament teachings and so on. Jesus obviously taught a lot of things that are true to the Jewish ear. And he obviously taught a lot of things that are true to the Christian ear. Nobody's saying that Jesus didn't say Jewish or Christian things. But this criteria is in the middle of these two, discontinuity or double discontinuity. And what it teaches is we can really be sure of the bricks, if you want to use that picture. We can really be sure of the bricks where the saying that Jesus gives does not follow Jewish thought, and neither is it reproduced in the early church. It stands by itself as a unique teaching. Well, then Jesus is probably the author. So again, very skeptical, because it sounds like, if you're going to use this rule, it sounds like Jesus is non-Jewish, non-Christian. Of course that's not true. No one says that that's true. But they're just saying, it's a, if you want to use a, you know, a $10 philosophical word, it's an epistemic test. It's an epistemological test for how do you know something to be the case. And they would say we could be most sure when it's not Jewish, it's not Christian, it seems to be very unique. Now, what would an example look like this? All right, let me give you an example. Jesus' favorite name for himself was the Son of Man. Now, many times in our sermons, I think, we frequently say, Son of God is Jesus' divine nature, Son of Man is Jesus' human nature. And there are some folks who think that, but for the most part, the answer is not so. Son of Man is as lofty a title as is Son of God. And they both point to something very special about Jesus in the category of which we call deity. And Jesus used this name, Son of Man, for himself. Now, why do critics take this so seriously? Well, they take it seriously because, first of all, Jewish sources do have a Son of Man. There is a Son of Man, especially in first century Jewish sources. The book of Enoch, for example, or First Enoch. And there's a subsection in Enoch called Similitudes. And in the Similitudes, a subsection of this early Jewish book, often said to be from the first century AD, what this helps us to do is see what Jews were thinking and saying in the first century. The Similitudes have especially lofty language about this Son of Man. For example, the Son of Man is worshipped. The Son of Man occupies God's throne. He sits on God's right hand. And sitting on God's right hand, he is a co-occupant of his throne. Those are probably the two loftiest things I could say. And a first century monotheistic Jewish milieu, the Son of Man is worshipped and occupies God's throne. You say, well, then how can that be discontinuity? The Jews used it, right? The Jews used the concept Son of Man, but they would not have applied it to Jesus, right? There's no way they're applying the Son of Man concept to Jesus. In fact, I'll give you an example. I'll come back to that in just a second. You say, well, what about the early church? Couldn't this be something where the early church, what we call in the States, because of our football games being on Sunday afternoon, we talk about Monday morning quarterbacking. Monday morning quarterbacking is where fellas sit in the barber shop on Sunday morning and tell what their favorite team should have done the previous day. Now, if you apply that to the New Testament, Monday morning quarterbacking would be maybe the New Testament epistle writers, Paul and others, maybe they're saying what they wish Jesus said during his life. And maybe they put those words in Jesus' mouth on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday morning, but they weren't there on Sunday when Jesus was alive. Okay, Son of Man, with Son of Man, we hear the argument, no, Jesus must have used this of himself before Monday started. Okay, how do you know? Here's why. Son of Man is Jesus' favorite title for himself, but it is never used a single time in the epistles. It never comes up a single time. So what's the juxtaposition? What's this opposite sense, this contrast between Jesus' favorite name for himself, but not the favorite name in the early church? How do you know? Because it doesn't even show up in the epistles. Now, it shows up in the book of Acts. Now, Acts is not an epistle. Acts is an extension of the Gospel of Luke. But you know where it shows up? The only place it shows up? When Stephen is dragged out to be stoned, and he looks up, and he sees Jesus on the right hand of God. And he's called the Son of Man. Now, here's this passage in Acts And the only place it shows up, basically, it's in Revelation without, it's a Nartharus. It does not have a definite article. But in Acts, it shows up, this Son of Man. But where is Jesus? On God's right hand. Which is, we just take that for granted so much. He's on the right hand of God. We sing about it. But it was highly blasphemous to be able to claim to be able to be seated on God's right hand. So again, the concept Son of Man, it's Jewish, but not applied to Jesus, never. And secondly, you might think it's Christian, quote unquote, it's Christian, and it is, but only because it's in the Gospels. It doesn't show up in the early church. It doesn't show up in a Monday morning quarterbacking kind of scenario where people would read it back into Jesus' mouth. So scholars have a real hard time saying that the Son of Man label was made up. Now let me show you how these criteria, how they can cross apply. Let's back up. Multiple attestation says that multiple independent sources report what we're talking about. Discontinuity says that Jesus didn't get it from Jewish or Christian sources. These two work together with Son of Man. Okay, how so? Because critical scholars generally find five sources in the Gospels. Now, I don't want to confuse anybody, but if you're interested in the five sources, I'm not talking about five Gospels. I'm not talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, or the Gospel of Thomas. Or Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, or the Gospel of Peter. I'm not talking about five sources. Five books. I'm talking about kinds of sources within the Gospels. For example, think of it this way. Luke 1:1-4, Luke says, having had knowledge of many sources related to Jesus, I have set my gospel, he's writing to one named Theophilus, and he says, O Theophilus, I've made sure of these things. And he even mentions eyewitness testimony, Luke does, which shows you, I'll just make a footnote here, shows you that in the ancient world, they were interested in eyewitness sources as well. And he says, I've been aware of all these sources. We know there are early sources for Jesus. And scholars find five within the four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. And they find five sources. Here's the five sources. Mark stands by itself. If it's in Mark, it's called Mark. Now, I often talk to my grad students, and we get teasing about this, and I'll say, what's it called if it's in Matthew and Mark? It's called Mark. What's it called if it's in Mark and Luke? Mark. What if it's Matthew, Mark, and Luke? It's Mark. It's called Mark. If Mark is there, it's the source called Mark, because it's the earliest gospel. So if the others use him at that point, it's Mark. Okay. Then there's material in Matthew that's nowhere else, and it's called special Matthew or simply M. Matthew has material that appears in no other gospel. So you have Mark, wherever Mark appears, M. Then Luke has material that's nowhere else. Let's call that L. So we have Mark, M, L, John. Mark and John are books that stand by themselves. So earliest would be Mark, M and L, John. Whoops, that's four. And one more. Now this is a confusing one. But a source that scholars take along with Mark as the earliest two sources, a source called Q, taken from the German word for source, and today it's just a hot topic as to whether this is a separate, whether there's a source of sayings in the ancient world. But whether there is or whether there isn't, let's just call Q, texts that are in Matthew and Luke in common, but not in Mark. See, if Mark's there, it's Mark. If it's Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark, it's Q. If it's Matthew alone, it's M. If it's Luke alone, it's L. If it's John, it's John. All right, everybody with me? Now, you just had a graduate introduction to New Testament here. Okay, five sources. Now, one of our rules is multiple attestation of sources. And another rule is discontinuity. I already said discontinuity is really helpful on Son of Man because it's not applied to Jesus by the Jews, and the early church made virtually no use of it from what we know. So Jesus must have called himself Son of Man. How does Son of Man stack up on multiple attestation of sources? Five possible sources, and Jesus is called the Son of Man in all five sources. So if you're going to sit here and you're going to say, well, what did Jesus say about himself? Well, he called himself the Son of Man. How do you know? Because out of five possible sources, he's called Son of Man in all five sources. He's called Son of Man in more than one gospel form. He's called Son of Man without it being taken from the Jews, and he's called Son of Man without it being taken from the church. So what do we have here? We have a really serious case for Jesus calling himself Son of Man. Now, why is this important? Well, for evangelicals, one very important thing in the life of Jesus is to talk about him being the Son of God, him being deity. I don't know how it is in Sweden. I can't even talk about how it is as a general rule in Western Europe or Northern Europe or Britain. But in North America, if you ask evangelical Christians, what are the best verses for the deity of Christ? For some reason, they will generally use these two arguments. John 8, John 10. John 8, before Abraham was, I am. John 10, I and the Father are one. And I tried to tell them, I mean, you know, part of graduate school is to upset people, right? And then kind of put their worldview back together again, give them better reasons. I tell them I wouldn't even use John 8 and John 10. I think they're sort of ambiguous. It's the latest gospel. Can we put a better critical foot forward? You say, well, okay, well, I'm open. What text would you use? Well, there's a lot of texts that I would use, and maybe I can stop, and if we have time later, they pass these rules. But one text, if I had to pick only one text to show that Jesus thought of himself as deity, I would use Mark 14, 61 to 64. Now notice what happens in this text. Jesus appears before the high priest. There's a number of signs that this passes critical muster. Now, I'll just say this, here's my end note. If you want, a lot of contemporary New Testament scholars spend time on this, both European and North American scholars spend time on Mark 14, 61 to 64. But Darrell Bach of Dallas Seminary, very well known, very well published New Testament scholar, Darrell Bach has written an entire book on this passage, and he had a sabbatical. So he went to Tübingen, Germany, to a theological library, which he said for his purposes was second to none in Tübingen. And he studied all the Jewish sources in the original languages on, well, the name of the book is Exaltation and Blasphemy in Ancient Judaism. And he studied sources on exaltation and blasphemy. What did you have to do to, for example, be a blasphemer in ancient Israel? And he produces the results, and many other New Testament scholars like the Canadian Craig Evans, British scholars like I.H. Marshall and N.T. Wright, you get these, Martin Hengel from Tübingen, you get these across the board as kind of a general consensus. And here's what they come up with. When the high priest decided to ask Jesus kind of a tete-a-tete, kind of a, head-to-head kind of notion. It's almost like he sent the witnesses home. The witnesses weren't doing their job. If you remember the story, they were conflicting with each other, and they're trying to nail Jesus with these claims that were blasphemy, and they weren't working. So it's almost like the high priest said to Jesus, it's almost like he said, you and me right here, okay? I'm sick and tired of sending my people out into the countryside and have you walk all over them with your debate techniques, okay? So this is going to be just you and me, mano a mano. Okay, you ready? Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, one of the things Daryl Bach points out that makes us authentic is notice the avoidance of God's name, which is really Jewish. Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Which we would interpret as, are you the Messiah, the Son of God? Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? And Jesus says, now, he's going to be speaking in Aramaic, but in the Greek New Testament, he says, ego me, I am. There is scholarly discussion is about whether this ego me has anything to do with the I am of Exodus chapter 3. I think that would probably grab some people's attention, but the public, it seems, from my limited study on this, it seems that most scholars just think he's making a straightforward affirmation. That's strong enough. But are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Ego me, I am. And then Jesus offers some more for free. He extends the testimony, and he says, henceforth, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds and on the right hand of God. And the high priest grabs his clothes and rips them, which is a formal declaration of blasphemy, and he says, do we need any more of witnesses? I got you. I mean, you can believe he was glad to tear those clothes. He was glad because, you know, it's a mano a mano thing, once again, and he did it. He forced Jesus into a corner, or so he thought. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Ego me. I'm the Son of God. But henceforth you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds and on the right hand of God, and he implies he's coming in judgment. Now, just a couple things here. If Son of Man only means a human being, the high priest, you would think, would say, no. I ask you, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Don't give me the Son of Man thing. You're the Son of Man. I'm the Son of Man. We're all sons of men. But when Jesus says sons of man, that seems to bother him more than Son of God does. But anyway, we have our bases covered. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Ego me. And I'm the Son of Man coming on the clouds. You know what the phrase coming on the clouds in the Old Testament? It's used many times. It applies only to God or to one of the gods. He talks about gods who claim to ride on the wind. But God rides on the clouds. And Jesus said, you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. And then he says, seated on the right hand of God. And New Testament scholars, a whole group of them here, are agreed. It's not the ego me that got him in trouble. It's not the Son of Man that got him in trouble even. Coming on the clouds, the one that really got him in trouble was right hand of God. But of course, this early Jewish document, first century, claims that the Son of Man sits on the right hand of God. But Jesus says, that's me. You know the one who's on the right hand of God? That's me. And he declares, case dismissed. He's a blasphemer. You deserve to die. It's not from saying, ego me, to Son of God. Son of Man was, that was bad enough. But when you said your place is on the right hand of God, you die. You're a blasphemer. Which, by the way, now that's a little bit of help when we talk about Stephen's martyrdom, and he says he sees Jesus in the right hand of God. That's really going to infuriate these folks. Okay, but we have backup. I'm just giving an example of how these things fit together. Multiple attestation, 5 out of 5. Multiple forms, yes, we have more than one form, and it cannot be attributed to either a Jewish or Christian source. So this is the kind of brick building, if the wall we're making is Jesus' claims about himself, we're starting to get a pretty good looking wall here. Now there's some other bricks that would go into this wall. In Mark chapter 2, Jesus forgives sin. And the Jewish leaders say, you can't do that, only God can forgive sin. And Jesus says, right? And to show you that I can forgive sin, I'll heal this man. Which, by the way, this is an apologetics conference. There's an example of apologetics being used by Jesus. Son, your sins are forgiven. You can't forgive sins. Only God can forgive sins. Oh yeah? Well, to show you I can forgive sins, son, you're healed. That's the healing is the evidence that he was able to forgive sins. So evidences are used. We talk about miracles being signs. Miracles are pointers, like a sign. Pointer, turn here. Turn here. We had a GPS this morning. A lot of signs on the GPS. The sign gives directions. And Jesus says the healing is a sign. It's a pointer to Jesus being able to forgive sins. So there's an example. Another one is the so-called Johannine thunderbolt. The Matthew 11, 27 and the parallel of Luke. It's what they call Q. Very early. Now here's another one. Embarrassment. Now, when we get to embarrassment, we're sort of talking about second order rules, because the first five are like the biggies, and the next ones are helpful, but not quite as powerful, according to some scholars. But embarrassment is helpful. There are many, many embarrassing sayings or events in the Gospels. And I just mentioned a couple in a way. Jesus tried to forgive sin? How embarrassing. Nobody would attempt to forgive sin unless you're able to forgive sin. That's kind of embarrassing or surprising. Embarrassing or surprise kind of go together. But that's very surprising, also somewhat embarrassing, to be able to claim to forgive sin. And that's kind of a shocker. Here's another embarrassing one that points to, I've been using this theme, example of wall building, who did Jesus think he was? Let's try another one that's pretty embarrassing. In Mark 13, 32, Jesus is giving the Olivet Discourse, and he says, then I'm going to return. And he says, that day or hour knows no one, not even the angels, nor the Son, but the Father only. Now in this passage, he's not the Son of God, but he's the Son of the Father, which effectively is Son of God. He's the Son of the Father. But as one British New Testament scholar says, that is incredibly embarrassing. If you're going to say you're the Son of God or Son of the Father, just say it. Just say, I'm the Son of the Father, and whoever's spiritual will know that I'm speaking the truth. Say something like that. But don't say, I'm the Son of the Father, and I don't know when I'm returning. Whoa. If you're the Son of God, why in the same sentence do you tell me you don't know something? Man, for a minute there I thought you were claiming to be God, but now you blew it. See, it's kind of embarrassing. But in that sentence, in the Olivet Discourse, then comes the time, the return, and no one knows, angels don't know, not even the Son. Only the Father knows. Well, why don't you know that? See, even the fact that you would have to ask that question, if a critic says, I got you on this one, this is a real tough one for you. But see, if he's assuming it's a tough one, he's conceding it as something Jesus taught. You get me? So how do you account? This is a worse problem for the skeptic. Why does Jesus call himself the Son of God? It's embarrassing. Enemy attestation. What happens when an enemy concedes something? Now, a favorite is Jesus' miracles. I've been kind of going back and forth between miracles and the claims of Jesus here. Just a second. Just before I do that, let me mention a couple things right here. I said that there were many embarrassing things in the Gospels. What else? I already started this morning by saying we have multiple texts. That's number three. Multiple attestation. Four, an embarrassing thing, namely, Jesus' brother didn't believe in him. That's Mark and John. Mark 3, John 7. That's two independent sources. So, it's multiple attestation, rule number three. And it is, it's quite embarrassing. Quite, surprised that his family thought this of him. Here's another one. The chief apostle, Peter, denies his Lord three times after saying, I'll go to my death on your behalf. Whoops, not this time. And Peter denies his Lord. Very embarrassing. So you've got the leader of the early church, embarrassed of his Lord. You've got the pastor of the church of Jerusalem, James, and he's not even a believer, although he lived with Jesus for a while. And doesn't believe. These are bricks. These are bricks on our wall and things we can be pretty sure of. Whoops. Where am I? What did I do, Peter? There we go. All right. Enemy. Where are some enemy examples? Well, Marcus Borg, he's a Oxford-trained American scholar, says that when it comes to the miracles of Jesus, he says, we've got some reasons to believe Jesus is a miracle worker. Do you know that when I went to graduate school in the mid-1970s, when I was doing my PhD, if you believed Jesus did miracles, they knew you were an evangelical. You were giving it away that you were pretty conservative. But today, it's virtually unanimous that Jesus was a miracle worker. Well, what's going on? Well, there's a number of reasons. Here's one. Let's go. I'm not going to keep flipping back, but remember our third rule, multiple sources? How many are there? Five. How many of them say Jesus is a miracle worker? Five. Son of Man? Five out of five. He's a miracle worker? Five out of five. Do you see how good the evidence is here for this? Multiple sources, yes, did miracles. But how about enemy attestation for doing miracles? What did the Jewish leader say? And Marcus Borg says, I can give you some reasons why Jesus is a miracle worker. He says, number one, we have great source attestation. Five out of five. We have good source attestation. But here's another one. His enemies conceded it. And remember we started out by saying, if Caesar's enemies say he's a lousy person, bad father, bad husband, bad everything, but man, was he a good general? Then chances are he's a good general, because everybody else hates his guts, but he's a good general. All right. Well, what about enemy attestation? They're standing right there while Jesus does miracles, and what do they say? Do they say you're a sorcerer? Which was a common thing in those days. Do they say you're faking it? They say you're lying? Or do we have early sources that say these things never happened? No. We have early sources where the Jewish leaders say, yeah, but whose power are you manifesting? You're doing this by Satan's power. Which means what? I'm really doing the miracles. Which means we have miracle bricks, right? We have miracle bricks. And what would they be? You'd look for sources that are early. Again, he heals the man who comes down through the roof. He first, in Mark 2, Mark is the early source. He's doing something that's very surprise, embarrassing. He forgives sins. He backs it up with a miracle. We're getting multiple bricks and we're getting multiple rules working here together. Another example, just yesterday, Ray Baker showed me a dissertation of a gentleman who did his PhD at the same university in Finland, where Ray is working. And this pastor picked a passage that is uniformly detested as way too strong, but uniformly dismissed by critical scholars, and it's the text where Jesus had a guard outside his tomb. Why? It's only in Matthew. We don't have multiple sources. We don't have rules. And they think, oh, that's just apologetic. People are making up rules. And this gentleman at Rice University, this man did 250 pages arguing that Matthew is employing a very early tradition and putting it, he's reporting a very early text, which is a very common thing in New Testament scholarship, that he's employing a New Testament text for the death of Jesus and for their guards being outside the tomb. So that would be an example of enemy attestation. That even the guards, whether you think they were Roman guards or Jewish temple guards, there's a discussion there, but Roman guards or temple guards, whoever it is, the fact that enemies would say, hey, we were standing in front of the tomb minding our own business, and next thing we knew, an angel came and the tomb was empty. Enemy attestation is often said to be better than somebody on the same side, right? We often say in our own languages, we'll say, yeah, but even Bob admits that, and Bob's an atheist. We do make that move all the time. That's enemy attestation. That's some more bricks. Well, the rest of these, as we go on, we're getting a little bit more minor, but I'll just fill in the last here in the last few minutes we have. Coherence, I myself don't, I mean, I'm not as crazy about this one, but some people are. Different people use different rules. Coherence works like this. If I have two texts where Jesus is talking about something similar, and I have good reasons for accepting this one, I'll give you an example. Jesus says in Matthew and Luke, so it's Q, it's not a Mark, Jesus says, many will come from the east and west and sit down in the kingdom with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So right away, critics are a little bit predisposed to take this because it's a quote-unquote Q passage. It's multiply attested. And he's talking about an early text. And so what if Jesus takes another text about dining in the kingdom? I will not eat this bread or drink this cup until I do it again with you in the kingdom. So you have a text that's accredited and another text that's not so accredited, but it sounds like it's this genre. Well, then maybe that second text, if we know this one to be true, this one is consistent with it, this is a good argument for this one also being something Jesus would have taught. That's coherence. So one hangs with another one for which we have good reasons. In the New Testament, there are a number of verses that have an Aramaic substrata. And by that I mean, maybe we read right over it in our New Testaments. But many times the Aramaic breaks through the text. The text is written in Greek. New Testament scholarship is almost unanimous, virtually unanimous, that Jesus spoke Aramaic. And sometimes the Aramaic words break through. This is probably the closest we get to what we call the verba abscissima, the exact words of Jesus. And you know, whenever these passages occur, they're in very lofty situations. There are a couple times, Jesus is casting out a demon. And he says, be opened, when he's healing a man who's deaf, right? Deaf, I believe he's deaf. He's not, I don't think he's blind. But he says, be opened. And he says it in Aramaic. Once when he raises the little girl from the dead, he says, rise. And he says it in Aramaic. On the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He calls his father Abba, a very personal name. Evangelicals used to say that Abba means daddy, and the critical community kind of... There was even an article published in a journal called Abba Does Not Mean Daddy. It maybe doesn't mean daddy, but it is a personal name for God. It's a personal name for God, and it's Aramaic. So what's another pointer to Jesus had a high view of himself? That he used the word Abba, because Abba is Aramaic. So that's a reason, one more reason here, and these rules will overlap, as I said. Okay. So, different New Testament scholars will use different rules, but virtually everybody. Oh, that's nice. I didn't even tell it to do that. Maybe I did. The first eight, and I'm glad it stopped there, at least for now. The first eight are used almost uniformly by virtually everybody. And it's often said that multiple attestation and discontinuity may be the two best that scholars use. But when they keep overlapping, and I've used two themes where they keep overlapping, Jesus' miracles and Jesus' view of himself. But both of those are topics that are highly relevant to an apologetics conference. Because for evangelicals, the miracles of Jesus are one of the mainstays of our argument. Jesus thinking of himself as deity, one of the mainstays of our argument. And both of them look very well, they look very strong when they're measured up by some of these criteria or rules. So what we're doing here this morning is building a historical Jesus, a sense of Jesus's historicity, instead of from the top down. The texts are good, therefore everything in him is trustworthy. And I think you can still argue that way. I think you can still argue the first way, but I think this works within the first way, and it's a second way to argue that does not conflict with the first way at all. But it says, within those texts, which are good texts that we can work our way down, we can work from the bottom up by using independent bricks, each of these bricks, or series of bricks, being established by rules. And as we start seeing how many bricks we have a very well-built wall, which equals a very strong historical count of Jesus. And it grows. And as it grows, it's just, I don't think a coincidence, I think it's sort of a design sort of argument. What we're starting to see here is the things that, to use Luke's phrase with Theophilus, things which are most surely to be believed among us, we're seeing that those are the things that are established by these early rules. And so we put together our life of Jesus. A little bit later today, we'll start working toward the resurrection and show how some of these things are fulfilled even more, and why today the resurrection is attested so positively.